Welcome to the World of Horror Special Edition Quinnisode, episode 112. I'm Christina.
And I'm Quinn.
This is the podcast where Quinn and I have a conversation about a work of classic horror and our Midwestern accents. For this Quinnisode, we are looking at George Cukor's 1944 psychological thriller film, Gaslight. Disclaimers for adult language and heavy spoilers. Let's move on to our first segment, Christina and Quinn Chat. Hi, Quinn. How's it going?
Hey, Christina. It's going okay. How are you?
Oh, it's fine. It's a trans-state-lantic Quinnisode.
Yeah, it is. I'm in Michigan. You're in North Carolina.
Yeah, I'm always in North Carolina.
Well, you're not always there, but yeah.
The last time I wasn't, my dad died. So, is that right? I think that's right. I need to go on a trip, y'all.
For some reason, I thought that you had a trip in between that.
I don't think so. I don't think I've crossed state lines.
We had a trip planned. To D.C.
To D.C.? Oh, no. I know. Oh, something sad happened. Cue balls. We don't need to go into it.
No, we've gone into it before, but our dear friend Cole died, but we all had the three of us had a trip planned to D.C., and it was going to be epic, but then COVID went ahead and happened.
And then he died. Because I think we were going to go, like, Easter of 2021, but he died in Feb of 2021.
I think we were going to go Easter of 2020.
Oh, you know what? I think you're right.
Yeah.
We were such dummies. We had no idea what was going on with the pandemic in those halcyon days.
Yeah. Oof. Okay.
I was thinking about that the other day. Like, I was just, well, I was kind of in a bad way. I was like, I wish I had taken better advantage of that time. That's a stupid thought. It's really unproductive. How can that help in any way? But that's where my brain goes sometimes. I'm like, man, I had a lot of time there. Like, I could have done a lot of things.
But yeah, no, I think that too, actually. I'm like, well, I could have been, like, I didn't create anything. You know, so many people created amazing art and found, like, different passions and stuff, and I didn't do anything like that. I kind of, honestly, I spent the whole time that we were in heavy lockdown just fucking worrying, because I couldn't take it. It was scaring me in terms of contact with people. Like, I don't know. I'm a very extroverted introvert or a very introverted extrovert, and I don't know which is which, but the thought of not being around a lot of people or talking to random strangers and stuff like that, like, was freaking me the hell out. And I spent a lot of that early time just like, how am I going to make it? How am I going to do this? I don't know. Are the dogs going to, like, go get sick of all my stories? I don't know. Like, it was tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think in retrospect, had we known what it was going to be like, I mean, or like the logistics of it, that maybe we would have done different things, but I mean, I'm sure we would have, but you're right. It's not really great to think about the what ifs and the whatevers, but yeah.
Yeah, and I had a lot of big plans for this summer, too, like always. But actually, I have done a lot of things. I've created a lot of art. I've recorded a bunch of podcasts. I've gone to therapy. I've done other things for my mental and physical health. So I would say that even though we've only got a month left before the students come back, it's actually been a pretty productive summer. And One good thing about time moving forward is it won't be summer so much. in a month. It still will be, but I think July is my, I think it's my least favorite month.
Yeah, it's it's all those like back to school sales that lurk in the background of everything that are like, you're a teacher and you had all this time off and you did nothing. And it's like, we didn't really have any time off though, subconscious. And we did a lot of things like we were working the whole time, but then it's these stupid like, hey, there's a sale on highlighters and colored pencils. Get all your back to school gear ready for fall. And it's, I don't like it. No one likes that. That's not cool. No. And just stop it with your sales. Stop it with your school sales. I'm done. I can't take it.
Well, yeah, but I think after the school stuff comes the Halloween stuff, and that always makes me feel happy. So we just have to get through the back to school. Like, there's nothing in between, is there? I don't think so.
No, I don't.
So once we get through the back to school, then we can move into Halloween season. And that's the best time of the year.
Yeah, but then right around the corner, it's Christmas season.
No, I don't want to think about that.
Valentine's season? And St. Patrick's season? And Easter season? It's back to school season again. And fireworks season.
Oh, God, what is it with fireworks? Like, I don't like them.
I don't either. So I'm in Michigan. I'm staying at my parents' house, and their neighbors are very much 4th of July loving folks. And they, I don't know how much they spent on fireworks, but probably a small fortune, of which I could have used, but, you know. I don't know. So I walked out there, I think it was on the 4th of July, and it was like just running an errand, and they had this big party going on. And this lady was like, hi, are these fireworks scaring your dog? And I was like, they're kind of scaring me, but I think my dog's losing her hearing. So like, and she's also very brave, so we're fine. And then, aww. Yeah, but they've got like, 3 dogs there, and they don't seem to be affected by any noise. And then apparently there's a pool in there, like, somewhere that I don't even see, and the grandma invited me to go swimming at night, and I was like, what is happening? And then she said to come back over for some food later, and what else did she say? I don't know, it was all this random stuff, and I never met the grandma. I know, like, the mom and dad, and then there's a random uncle that has a wiener dog that is oftentimes over there. But there's a lot of garbage in their yard, and the dogs just kick up the garbage, and, like, now the fireworks debris is being kicked up, and this is not a good story, and it had no point.
Well, I'm worried about this grandma, though, because I hope she's real, and I hope she's okay.
Well, she was like, her son lives there, her son and his wife, and they have, I don't know, maybe like 6 or 7 kids. And the grandma was like, I'm Scott's mom. And within the conversation, she was like, can Quinn come over and swim at night, Scott? I was like, what the hell? But I mean,
you met her?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I thought it was like Scott was like, grandma says you can come over and swim at night, but you never met the grandma.
No, but then when she asked Scott, he was like, I guess. I was like, what are you setting me up for, grandma?
Yeah, grandma.
I haven't gone.
Everything okay? Oh, no, I wouldn't.
Love to swim and I love water, but no, I'm not gonna go.
That says something right there.
Yes,
I was driving to go get some Coke Zeros, and somebody had set up in their front yard, they had set up like a kiddie pool, and then but there was all this like mosquito, there was like a mosquito net structure around the kiddie pool. So I was like, well, that's pretty, because I'm like, is that a hot tub? Like, what's going on? Because it was in the front yard. But I'm like, that's pretty good. I think that's pretty smart. Like, when I was a kid, well, first of all, we didn't have the fluffy kiddie pools. Mm-mm. You know, we didn't, that, I don't think that had, that material had been invented. So we just had the, like, really hard plastic kiddie pools.
Yeah.
And there wasn't any protection. I mean, you got into the kiddie pool because you were dying from the heat. And, but there was bugs and, you know, whatever was in there, but you just got in there.
Yeah, that would be smart, especially here, to have a net like that. And also, I've seen people are just like adults getting kiddie pools to just like lay in the water.
Yeah.
For like hours. And I'm like, you know what? That's a great idea. That's a fantastic idea.
I don't know what this material is, but it's like really, it's like hard rubber, but it's soft. And, you know, it's substantial. I mean, so why not? It's kind of like the really, really, maybe it is like a hot tub, but like the cheapest version of a hot tub.
Yeah.
An inflatable hot tub, kind of.
Yeah. Did you slip and slide when you were little?
Oh, gosh. I heard tell, but I don't think I would do that. That's the kind of thing I wouldn't do. There are a couple of things I didn't do when I was a kid, either because I was afraid or I was afraid of looking dumb or awkward. So that seems like something I wouldn't have done.
Yeah, I get that. It was never pleasant. I mean, I always wanted to do it, but like what would happen is that you ended up scraping your stomach on it because it wasn't properly wet down or whatever. I mean, in the early days, it was just like a piece of rubber that you slid on and hosed down. And then there was a slip inside that had a bump. And the song goes through my head sometimes from the commercial. It's like, you run, you slide, you hit the bump and take a dive. And I hear that going on in my head. But we had one of them, I think it was the early version, and it was such a pain, I think, to get out and set up that we did it maybe twice. And then my brother and I would kind of like beg my dad to take it out, and it would be such a hassle, and he would end up getting mad. But they were terrible. They might be okay now. I don't know if they're still around.
One thing I remember from when I was a really little kid, all my grandparents lived in Joplin, Missouri, and my grandma would take us to the park, you know, and she would bring along wax paper, and you would like slide down the slide on wax paper because the slide would be so mother freaking hot that you would burn yourself otherwise.
Yeah. That's so smart.
Well, she was a product of the Great Depression, so you know, those folks had a lot of ingenious.
Yeah, I remember obviously the slides of burning hell, but also the, I don't know what they're called, but you would jump on it and just would go in circles and someone would push you and different people could be on it. And then oftentimes it would, you would just fling off. Like if you weren't, I don't know, holding.
It was like a big swing, but it was like kind of like in a triangular configuration.
No.
Like a huge swing. Oh, sorry. No.
No, it was like a metal circle plate thing that had handles and there could be like 5 or 6 kids on it, and it would just, you could be pushed in a circle, like round and round.
No, I don't think so.
I just remember seeing people like fling off of it at recess or something.
Oh yeah. I got very badly injured when I was a kid. I'm thinking this was third grade. So what's that, like 7? I'm blanking on the name. Not merry-go-round, but is it a merry-go-round? No, merry-go-round has the animals on it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, it wasn't that, but it's a spinny thing that you sit on, you sit on these like slats, your legs go through the center, there's like a hole in the center, and people spin you around. What the fuck is it called? It's a common thing. Anyway, I fell, and there was like an exposed, I fell on the ground, and there was like an exposed screw or something that was holding this, because it was the 70s, you guys. Like, there weren't any, like, you know, you like fell onto concrete or like, you know, gravel. We didn't have like these like modern playgrounds where people like cut up tires and stuff. So if the kid falls, like they just bounce right back up again. It wasn't like that. So anyway, so yeah, I got really terribly badly injured. That was like one big injury to my head. And the other one, when I was probably about 7, I think I told you already, I went face first down a slide and I just hit the bottom of the pool and I had to get stitches like right in the front of my head.
Did you get knocked unconscious?
No. Unfortunately, I had to deal with like the shame and the embarrassment. But this was, you know, 70s was a weird time because like these kids from the pool that I had walked to by myself, which had to be at least a mile away, you know, walked me home with like, you know, blood running down my face to my mom. But yeah.
Aww.
But I'm okay. I think.
Yeah, I think you're okay. I had some head injuries as well. But, I mean, I fell out of a tree for sure.
Onto your head?
No, I mean, I don't think I fell onto my head, actually. I fell onto my knees, I think. But it was a kind of a bigger accident. But nothing, nothing really crazy. There was this... There was this store in my hometown. I think it was like a Hallmark store. They had, or no, it was like a, it was just a pharmacy. They had a drawing, and my parents like put my name and my brother's name in the drawing, just like whatever. And my name was drawn, and I mean, technically won a go-kart, but then we crashed it. Because yeah, but that was really cool at the time, but I don't know, I kept being reminded that it really wasn't mine. I think my brother was reminding me of that.
What?
He was like very, it sounds very like it. Clear to be like, you didn't write your name on it, it's just your name, but it's ours.
What?
Yeah, he was a little,
that's a bald-faced lie, Matt. Calling you out, Matt.
Matt.
Never listener to the show.
Friend of the show. No. No, not a friend of the show.
Frenemy of the show.
Frenemy of the show. He does get talked about on here a lot.
Did you ever see To Be or Not To Be with, it was actually a remake, which I never knew, but Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft, To Be or Not To Be?
No, I don't think so.
Oh my God, it's so funny. But, they, I can't remember why, but at one point he goes, we're world famous in Poland. And for some reason, I've been wanting to say that about this podcast, that we're world famous in North Carolina.
I want that to be the Quinisode tagline. World famous in North Carolina.
All right, starting today, we'll say that. We should probably get into this.
Yeah, let's get into this. Let's get into this.
Okay. So this film was directed by George Cukor. The screenplay was by John Van Druten, Walter Reich, and John L. Batterston. It was based on Gaslight, the 1938 play by Patrick Hamilton. And it stars Charles Boyer, I guess Boyer, Ingrid Bergman, Joseph Cotten, Nay Whitty, and Angela Lansbury. The cinematography was by Joseph Rutenberg, edited by Ralph E. Winters. It was released on May 4th, 1944, and it has a running time of 114 minutes.
No, it doesn't.
What do you mean?
No, it doesn't. You're crazy.
Why are you saying no, it doesn't?
You're crazy.
I fell for it.
You must have missed.
Oh, you're the worst, and I'm so stupid. No, but that's kind of funny because we thought we were watching it independently at about the same time, and then you asked me a question about a section I hadn't gotten to yet, and so I was just like, what is she talking about? And then when I got to this section, I was like, oh, okay. But yeah, so people have probably heard or used the term gaslighting at some point in their lives. And this movie is often credited with establishing the term. I don't think that's totally accurate, but maybe it is. Because this film involves a woman who is driven systematically insane by her husband, and he's doing that so that he can have her institutionalized, and then he can discover her aunt's fortune. And he's 10 years earlier, he killed the aunt. And that's a murder that's gone unsolved all this time. And he would have gotten away with it too if it weren't for Joseph Cotten, who comes to the rescue.
He's close to getting away with it. Yeah, and I think it's cool. It's interesting in terms of the term, you know, coming out of this movie, or because it really, like, Gaslight doesn't explain what it is at all. You know, it's no explanation of that. It only refers to the kind of the proof that she gets throughout the film that, you know, did you turn the gas light on? No, I didn't turn it on. No one did. You know, and it's because he's up in the attic looking for the aunt's jewels and the gas bubble is like in a different place. So like it lessens in the rest of the house because he's lighting it upstairs and he's like, I didn't turn that on. And none of the other people in the house, they all deny it. So it's kind of the marker of which she, you know, rates her insanity because it just keeps happening and she's asking everyone. And, you know, of course, there's many other things that happen, but that's a sort of consistent thing. But it's cool because it has nothing to do with the technique or anything. But yeah, but it's a very neat plot device within the film.
Yeah, and I think that like modern viewers might be a little bit confused as because it was a whole a completely different way of powering houses before the 20th century. And so yeah, like you said, if the gas is turned up in one part of the house, the lights will dim in other parts of the house. And so what's actually happening is, what's his name?
Greg.
Gregory?
Greg.
Greg is up in the attic. And he's doing that. And he's using the gas up there. But she doesn't know that. So she just assumes that it has to be happening in the main house. But everyone in the main house is like, no, I didn't do anything with the gas. So it's like, and as all that's happening, he has been sort of subtly in the beginning and then ever increasingly undermining her confidence in her own sanity.
Yeah, it is. It's hard, you know, upon this second watch to talk about it today. I found it really uncomfortable to watch. I know that we thought so because we watched this with Mac for Squad several weeks ago, and we were just, you know, squirming kind of with each other because it's so uncomfortable. It's so outright and disgusting. And then to watch it again, I don't know, it's hard. It's not an easy watch because the entire film is like you want to just punch Gregory, you know, every single scene. He's so good at this. And it's cool to watch it again soon after you've watched it. Although uncomfortable, it's interesting to really keep your focus on him because you really can see him coming up with these gross plans. You can see a light come on in his face when she says something and he's like, ooh, I'm going to do this next. You know, you just see it, you know, even when, like, there's a point where they've been invited to a dinner party and he already responds that they can't go because she's ill. But she gets all ready to go that night. And he's like, no, I already said we weren't going. And she said, but I really want to go. And he's like, well, if you want to go, then you're going to go on your own. And she finally says, well, then that's fine. I will go on my own. And then he starts laughing. He's like, Paul, I would never. You didn't think I was serious, did you? And then he's getting ready, and you can see him look in a mirror, and this smirk comes on his face. And you find out later when they're at this party where there is, you know, an opera singer or a pianist and an opera singer, and she's really enjoying herself. He starts one of his little schemes to get her to think further that she's crazy by saying that she's taken his watch and then finds it in her bag. And she's like, I don't remember. No, this didn't happen. I didn't do that. I wouldn't have done that. But to a point, she's like, well, if I did do that, I don't know about it. So I am crazy. And it's just hard to watch, but it's interesting to watch his performance the second time when you know it's coming.
Yeah, and I think that's really funny because, and there was a lot of criticism in the Letterboxd reviews about this, like, that she was dumb, and it's unbelievable that it was so easy for him to get away with this, because what we see in, which I disagree with, we see him in the beginning, but they haven't known each other. They don't know each other. They only met 2 weeks before they get married. Then they go on his honeymoon, and it's sort of like he makes her think that it's her idea to move back into her dead aunt's home, which she has inherited in London. Her first thought is maybe they could go live in Paris. He says at one point, oh, you know how you're, you know, you forget things. You forget little things from time to time. And she's like, no, I don't. What do you mean? Why do you say that? And she's smiling. But then once that seed is planted, and he's also told the staff that their mistress is quite ill, you know, then he takes her away from society, basically just keeps her in this house. So she doesn't have any outside, you know, she can't do a reality check with anything outside the house or outside her marriage. And so, yeah, she's like, well, maybe this is true. And he goes from being sort of like amused and then kind of concerned to just like outright angry. And that's also very hard to watch. You know, at one point he's like full on yelling at her. And it's very difficult.
Yeah. Then I just remember too the scene, you know, she wants to have the house full of people like it was, you know, if she's going to be there, she wants it to be like it was when her aunt lived there and she had these, you know, parties all the time and just a lot of people and laughter and music. So the whole film, she's kind of talking about that and how she wants that. And then at the end, near the end, you know, when it's full on, he's really convinced her. He said, well, there will be people at the house too. In fact, I think that's how many that we need to commit you, you know?
Yeah. 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 And I think I read in the trivia that Ingrid Bergman did not want to do this role at first because she thought of herself as very strong and independent as a person. And so she wasn't sure, you know, that she wanted to portray this kind of character. And in the beginning, she is super confident, you know, and she's kind of thrilled, I guess, to be sort of swept off her feet in a way. But when she's showing him the house, she just has a whole lot of confidence about herself and what she wants and that kind of thing. And then that just gets degraded by him over the course of the movie. And that's, I think, what is another thing that makes it difficult, because we see her in the beginning as such a strong person.
Yeah, I think it's good, though, because in terms of the technique of gaslighting, I guess. I don't know why I keep referring to it as a technique. But I think it's a good portrayal of how easy it is to succumb to something like that when there's such a force behind it, such a manipulative evil force that is doing the convincing. I don't agree with those letterboxed reviewers that she's so stupid and stuff. I think that it's done so subtly in the beginning and then just slowly pumps up and pumps up and pumps up that it almost is more of a reflection of how easy it is to come under the spell of someone like that if you're not uber conscious of everything all the time, you know? Like, I feel like I've for sure been gaslit in ways by certain people, you know? I think a lot of the hangups that we have as adults, maybe like we're pieces of information that were told to us in an untrue way, you know, at some point in our formative years.
I mean, even this was not what I was thinking of. It just occurred to me that I think adults have a tendency sometimes to gaslight children. It's not so bad. Like, you fall down and you're in pain. And then they're like, no, you're fine. It's okay. It doesn't hurt. You know, and it's like, no, it fucking hurts. Like, you know, that kind of thing. And maybe parents do. It's not like in this case where this guy has a plan and he puts his plan into action. I don't think parents are necessarily doing that. But I do feel like we can all relate at least in some way to somebody discounting our perception of reality. Yeah. I think every person in the world can relate to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right. I think adults do it to kids, even, you know, in situations where there's a change occurring, you know, like if you're moving to a new school and you see parents saying like, it'll be great, it'll be fine. And not taking into consideration how maybe not fine it will be and how that's okay that it's not fine because things change. But yeah, I think it's probably very easy to do that. And I've done that with my nieces. When they fall, I'll be like, okay, that's fine. You know, like, oh no. You know, I mean,
I think there's a way to do it. And I hope that the culture is getting better about that, about like understanding that you don't have to lie to children. And one new thing that I've seen that I love is honoring a child's desire not to kiss or be kissed by somebody, or be, you know, go give grandma a hug. Well, if you don't want to give grandma a hug, then you should be allowed to say, I don't feel like it. Or if you don't want to get a kiss from your drunk uncle at the end of the Christmas party, you should be able to say, no, thank you. So I think that is a slight change that's happening in the culture that I think is great. And I do think people are becoming more aware of just abuse and, you know, just the strategies that some abusers may use in relationships to try to control their partners. And I mean, this happened to me on a pretty large level. I don't want to go into the details, but I find it a little offensive when people say that this can only happen to stupid people, because, excuse me, I'm a pretty intelligent person and it happened to me. So I really think that we should try to have a little more empathy for people in the real world, if not for, you know, fictional characters. But
yeah. So again, this speaks to your point in the beginning, saying that she is a very strong and independent character. We see that at the beginning. And so we don't feel like that it's an easy road for her to go down. You know, like it wouldn't be an easy road for anyone, but it's not, it doesn't have any, I don't think it has anything to do with the individual. It has something to do with the person on the other side of that. And on this side, it's Greg. And he is right. Just a punchable human.
Yeah. Somebody said that in Letterboxd too. Let's talk a little bit about the supporting characters. We've got, I'm blanking on the character's name, maybe you remember, but the nosy neighbor across the way played by Mae Whitty.
This is Wait.
Yes. Oh my gosh. She's just a joy.
She really is. And I think when we watched it for Squad, either you or Mac said that she's just one of the original true crime fangirls.
Yeah. She meets Paula on the train and becomes sort of intertwined in her business. And that's a good thing, because then Brian, the hero played by Joseph Cotton, can get, you know, involved. He goes to Scotland Yard to sort of, you know, investigate things. But she's just a busybody, but she also just kind of loves life. You know, she says good morning to her flowers, and she, you know, she talks to the pigeons as she feeds them in the square. And I don't know, I think she's a delight.
Yeah. And she has her digestive biscuits.
Digestive biscuits.
Yeah, she's fantastic, and she kind of does serve as like, oh, I hope she's gonna figure this out. She's gonna figure this out. She's gonna be the one, and she kind of becomes this ray of hope that keeps getting stomped on until the end. And then, as you mentioned, Brian, who was played by Joseph Cotton, he is somebody that knew Paula's aunt, who was a famous singer, you know, when he was young. And she actually gave him one of her gloves. And Paula knows the story, and she knows that there is one glove that her aunt kept. And she always asked her about the other, and her aunt always said, I gave it away to an admiring fan, and it turns out to be Joseph Cotton as a little kid. So he is definitely devoted to this idea of, you know, seeing Paula, seeing that she looks exactly like her aunt, first thinking he's seeing a ghost, and then trying to get to the bottom of things. He's great in this. Fun, adorable. Mm-hmm. As always, I mean, he's Joseph Cotton. He is cool as hell.
And we know him, of course, from Citizen Kane and from Shadow of a Doubt. Seems like there was something else that we watched recently, but maybe not. We just love him to death. He's wonderful. Yeah. And I was kind of looking up his biography before we got started, and I sent you that wonderful story that I'll put a link to it in the notes, but apparently he and Orson Welles remained friends until Cotton's death. And that just kind of warms my heart that they had such an abiding friendship.
Yeah, I love that too. I loved that story. He's just one of my favorite. I think he's one of my favorite actors. He's great. Love him. I love his face. He's so cool. He's just so cool. Oh, I was going to just mention Angela Lansbury, because, I mean...
Oh, of course.
She kind of steals a lot of scenes that she's in. She plays one of the maids, the younger maid, Nancy. And she really does, I think, really work to serve as evidence that Paula is going crazy as well, because she is very complicit with Greg's desires, or I mean, I think he just convinces her very easily that the mistress is ill, and she just sort of goes and runs with that very far.
Yeah, and there is one scene, well, there are two scenes, one where he's sort of openly flirting with her in front of Paula, which is quite strange, and she expresses that she doesn't like it. But there's another scene where he's like, it's just him and Nancy. And he's like, I hope you'll be careful when you go outside or when you're going home, because you know that a lot of people would like take advantage of such a young person. She's like, ha, not me. I can handle myself. And we know that she's having an affair with this like police officer, this beat cop that's in the neighborhood. And I was thinking, I don't know if you would agree, but I just think she's the definition of the word saucy.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. She's great. She's not super likable, but she's great.
No. And she just seems pretty free with her opinions and her sexuality. And I just love her. And in the 1940 version, the names are all different, but the Greg in that version takes the Nancy out and they go see a can-can show. So they, you know, they take it even further that, you know, he's actively having a relationship with this maid while he's driving his wife crazy.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe is that in that version, she probably is more, complicit. And
oh yeah, she's outwardly she wants to have a relationship with him.
Yeah.
You know, and it seems like he's interested at some level.
Yeah.
Having a relationship with her too.
And interestingly enough, in this version, the 44 version, her attitude works so well to realistically present a scenario that Paula would be intimidated by her, because he is, and he's like, he loves to just say things to the effect of, you're scared of the help are scared, you know, they scare you, you're afraid of them, you need to ask for help but you won't, and you know, and it's just like, that was hard to watch too. But even just her attitude, not necessarily, I don't think she was meant to be like an evil presence at all, Nancy, but just her attitude really works in his favor. And also, you can see how she might be intimidated by this force, this presence, because she really, like, she is a presence, Nancy.
Yeah, I know. And it does kind of remind me a little bit of Rebecca, in that just in the scenes where, like, he's insisting that she call the help to put some pieces of wood on the fire. He's like, well, your mistress called you, Paula, tell her what you wanted. And Paula's like, like she would just rather do it herself.
Yeah.
She doesn't want to be in this position, you know, and then the maid's like, okay, I'll like do this for you. Like, of course it's like my job, so I don't know why this is getting weird.
Yeah.
It's just all like awkward, and I can totally relate. And it just kind of reminds me of the like broken figurine scene.
Yes!
You know, in Rebecca.
And also when the picture is moved.
Yeah.
And also when Gregory's away. I want to just keep calling him Greg, and I think I will. When Greg's away at one point, Paula is going to go for a walk, and Nancy's like, what are you doing? And she's like, oh, I'm just going for a walk. And she's like, where will you be walking to? What should I tell Greg, you know, when he comes back and asks? And finally, all these questions that she's asking her, she's like, fuck, okay, I'm going back inside. And you can see how mm-hmm. this pattern continues easily.
Yeah, and what's great about that is that Joseph Cotton and Mae Whitty see this whole thing, and they're just like, okay, there's something odd going on in that house. We don't know exactly what it is, but that's strange that she got all dressed up to go for a walk, and then she, you know, she hesitated to the point where she just, like, you know, didn't even get half a block away and had to, like, go back. There's something amiss here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very well done with those mm-hmm. tiny scenes that do so much.
And it's so great that the character of Brian is so interested and invested in this family that he goes to try to investigate what happened. You know, why is this murder still open? You know, and then he finds out that there are jewels, missing jewels. And he's like, well, obviously, seems like that's an important detail that we should probably nail down.
Yeah, and the police are just very quick to say, this is a closed case. You know, and just kind of keep saying that as a means of shutting him up.
So Brian's like, okay, so then he just, like, asks this cop, is he a friend? I don't know. But he's just like, I'm going to try to pull some strings so that I'm going to move you to another beat. You know, so he's basically got a guy on the inside who can spy on, Greg, you know, and does. And that's really important in terms of the final confrontation.
I'm getting a lot of pleasure out of hearing you call him Greg and me calling him Greg. It feels like we're taking a lot of power away from him. And I like this.
Greg. Well, it should be I mean, he's got this, like, I mean, it's not his fault, you know, the actor is French, you know, but he's got this, like, ridiculous accent. And, you know, he's just, he's very condescending to Paula. And
yeah,
so, yes, I think.
His eyebrows get more of a workout than mine, I think.
Anyway, this is a great movie, Wohos and Cue Balls. If you haven't seen it, I would recommend it. Would you recommend it, Quinn?
Yeah, I would absolutely recommend it. It's tough to watch. It's dark. It's awkward, but it's great. And I think that anyone interested in the psychology of any of this or seeing a portrayal of it, I feel like this is a pretty great portrayal of this, of gaslighting. I mean, so absolutely, even if you're just interested in psychology and are interested in that behavior, I would recommend it for that. But cinematically, it's gorgeous too. We didn't really talk about the cinematics of it, but it's, I mean, it's beautifully lit, beautiful shadows, a lot of great angles, and I don't know. It's just, I would fully, wholeheartedly recommend.
Yeah, me too. I love it. I rented it on Prime, but I did notice that you can view it for free on some channel called Xumo. I think it's XUMO maybe, but you can probably find it streaming somewhere, maybe with commercials, but otherwise you can rent it on Prime in the States. A couple of pieces of trivia. George Cukor suggested that Ingrid Bergman study the patients at a mental hospital to learn about nervous breakdowns. Question, is nervous breakdowns like a thing? Like, is that actually a phenomenon? Or is that like an outdated umbrella term for, I don't know, having a mental health crisis?
I don't know. I mean, my gut instinct would be to say that it's probably an outdated term, but I think I still, yeah. I mean, I still hear the word breakdown. Yeah.
Mental health. Cue balls, get in touch. She did, focusing on one woman in particular whose habits and physical quirks became part of the character.
Oh.
The first time Ingrid Bergman encountered Charles Boyer was the day they shot the scene where they meet at the train station and kiss passionately. Boyer was the same height as Bergman, and in order for him to seem taller, he had to stand on a box, which she kept inadvertently kicking as she ran into the scene. Boyer also wore shoes and boots with 2-inch heels throughout the movie.
Oh, it would have been, I actually think that it would have been fun for him to be appearing as his own height.
I do too.
I would add something.
She also apparently hated that so much, like having the first scene be the love scene, that when later she had to do a love scene with Anthony Perkins in a film I've never heard of called Goodbye Again from 1961, she asked Perkins to kiss her privately in her dressing room to prepare for the scene so she would not be embarrassed and flustered while kissing him on screen.
That seems genius.
She's so smart.
Yeah.
So Angela Lansbury, according to this, was only 18 when she was in this film. This was her first film, and she'd been working at a place called Bullock's Department Store in L.A. When she told her boss she was leaving, he offered to match the pay at her new job. Expecting it to be in the region of her Bullock salary of the equivalent of $27 a week, he was somewhat taken aback when she told him she would be earning $500 a week.
Oh, nice.
Whew. And that's $1,944.
Yeah, wow.
Wow. which is, I think, about $1 million today.
Oh, yeah.
Now I want to know how much it is. I also like this, too. Angela Lansbury lights a cigarette in one scene, and she was only 17 at that moment when they were filming. And so Ingrid Bergman insisted that she wait until she actually turned 18 before they shot that scene. So she was, as a 17-year-old, she was being monitored by a social worker who refused to allow her to smoke. So the scene had to be postponed until she turned 18. When Lansbury walked on the set on her birthday, Bergman and the crew had organized a party for her, and the cigarette scene was shot immediately after they celebrated her birthday.
Oh, I love it!
She, Angela, was also nominated for an Academy Award for this film, first film.
It's incredible.
Ingrid actually won for leading actress in a, or whatever the award's called. She won an Academy Award for this.
Wow, yeah.
Role. I like this too. In her autobiography, Ingrid Bergman called Charles Boyer the most intelligent actor with whom she ever worked and one of the nicest. He was widely read and well-educated and so different, she wrote.
Oh, well then I'm not super familiar with a lot of his work, so this role, because he's so disgusting and despicable, I find him to be an amazing actor if he is really a very pleasant and, you know, I don't know, widely read, educated. Dude, I'm impressed.
Me too. I think that's so great. I really like Ingrid Bergman. I love the whole family. Like, you know, I love Ingmar Bergman's films. And I was trying to think today. So we talked a little bit before about how I don't think I'm going to watch Last House on the Left. But that movie was based on an Ingmar Bergman film called Virgin Spring, which I think I have seen or I heavily researched. So I'm going to see. I might do that for the for Foundational World of Horror as an alternative to Last House on the Left. But and then of course Isabella Rossellini.
Isabella, yeah, yeah.
She's so wonderful.
Yeah, they're wonderful. I love Ingrid. I used to be so into her when I was younger or in high school and college. I just found her to be just the epitome of the classic movie star.
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, she just, she's, you can almost see her eyes sparkling and her enthusiasm and then just also her defeat at certain points in the movie and her, you know, she does amazing things with her body language and I just think she's fantastic.
Yeah. And I think, again, I think it is, it's her role as this independent woman that slowly, you know, is just taken down and deflated and deflated and deflated, that her performance is so great in this. When she goes, I mean, there's a scene where she is dancing and singing and blissful, and the next second he says, oh, I hate to mention this, but that picture is moved. He doesn't say that like that. You know, he makes it much more dramatic than that, you know, and it just, she's like, no, you know, and it just completely from one second to the next. I mean, it's such a feat. It's exhausting to watch. So I can't even imagine. I just, she's great.
Yeah. I love her. We love her.
Yeah.
Another patron saint of the Quaisodes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Along, I think we already had Angela Lansbury, so, you know, this movie's like a 3-for-1 with Joseph Cotten. So.
Yeah, we cannot leave him out. We are mega fans.
Would you like to read the 5-star Letterboxd reviews?
Absolutely. So the first one is from Kate. Kate says, should absolutely be required watching for teens, but especially young women. It would have helped me for sure. I can't believe this movie has been around for 80 years. Most people don't know about it. How fortunate for shitty men the world over. It's masterful to watch how the tiny comments morph into unbelievable lies. Hard to watch in some spots because of the too real manipulations and dialogue. A new favorite. Yeah. The second one is... Yo, Adrian, we did it! Oh my gosh! Old Quinn! Old Quinn got it! All right. Yo, Adrian, we did it, says tremendous and disturbing. Ingrid Bergman's performance is fragile, unsettling, and often dreamlike. This film is exhausting to watch, and that is not a criticism. Ooh, took the words out of my mouth. Next one is unedited, and why? Auntie. Oh, whatever points I just earned have been taken away. Unedited Andy says, disgusting piece of shit over at husband HQ thinking he can do that to Paula. I love that.
I know, me too.
Next one is from Ellie. Ellie says, me and my friends would have beat Gregory Anton to death with hammers, I'll tell you that much. I love it. Next one is from Zoe, who says, this shit slapped and counts as an ab glute workout because mine were clenched the entire time. Half of the time in suspense, the other in pure rage. Seriously, I've never hated a man in a movie as much as I hate Gregory Anton. Literally every time he opened his mouth, I was like, how dare you? Which just shows how well written this is. And can we talk about his use of shadows? Or the use of shadows? Yeah.
In the Tower of London, that part, or the museum, or whatever. Oh my gosh, where she... He has given her a cameo, and then without her knowledge, she's taken it out, and she can't find it. And she's really worried about that. So she betakes herself away. And then we just see her shadow.
Yes.
And it's, oh no, it's so good.
When he's coming up the stairwell, you can see his actual, body in the frame. Yes. He's looking at the shadow. Oh.
Yes. Bravo.
Yeah.
So good.
So good. And also, before we started the recording, you mentioned the scene where he's looking at the jewels and basically having an orgasm. So I had to go yes. back to that after I was finished because I didn't catch that. And whoa, that scene is great.
Yeah, I had mentioned that we just recently watched this, and I guess I zoned out at that point before, because when I saw it today, I was just like, he's in ecstasy, really, like looking at the crown jewels in this configuration. She's sort of like, oh yeah, like she's been to this before. She's probably gone with her aunt to see these yeah. before, so she's like pointing these out, like you know it's like a tourist attraction, and he's just in awe
yeah.
of them, and it should be a red flag, definitely.
Yeah. And at the end of that scene, it kind of culminates with him just sort of very slowly, breathlessly saying, I love jewels. it's like I didn't even catch it when we were watching it for Squad that that the jewels had anything to do with it until later. Like, that didn't give anything away. So, red flag land. I did not see that until third watch, I guess.
So now one good thing about these reviews is there were not that many that were half star reviews. So I think that says something about the film. I know it's from 44, so it's not like, all the reviews you're going to see for the latest Insidious movie that just came out or something like that. But I was pretty pleased that there weren't that many like really horrible reviews of this film.
Yeah.
So Patty, I've got two exclamation marks, gave it 2 stars. This movie sucks. I hate old people. Naiguten gave it 2 stars. Some interesting changes compared to the original, but it only serves to make it longer, not better.
Pretentious.
I don't know. I really like Angela Lansbury, and you know, Dame Witty, Dame May Witty is just so wonderful. And I think I read the first time that she only started her acting career like in her 70s or something. And I think she's in her 80s in this film.
Oh, yes. Wow.
Chris gave it 1.5 stars. Didn't like it.
Thanks.
And that's the kind of review that I'm like, you took the time to write that.
Yeah. That's like on Amazon when somebody asks a question about a product and then someone says, I don't have this product, so I don't know. Why?
Why are you? You're not getting points for keystrokes. I don't know. Yeah. But
no one appreciates that.
Weber gave it 1.5 stars. Eh, listen. If you want a good laugh and talk with a friend during this movie, it's pretty good. But if you're here for a good movie night alone, then get the heck out and don't come back. Maybe if the story was a bit more fast-paced and the characters more in-depth, it'd be better. But it just felt silly with not much story to the characters. But it's 1944, so of course some slack to them. I'm sure the movie was good back in the day.
I'm so mad right now.
We're recording. It's not like the hottest day of the year, but it's pretty freaking hot. And I just feel like looking at these reviews today, I was just like extra angry.
Yeah.
You know, I think, I don't know if I can blame it on the weather, but it just made me mad, some of these reviews.
Yeah. And I have to say, like, and I know you agree, of course, but the idea of somebody dismissing a movie because it's old makes me so disheartened. And I know that, I mean, I teach an intro to film class and I show a lot of black and white movies. And a lot of my students, the majority of them end up loving them by the end, you know? So there is, but a lot of them go into it with like, I can't get into it because it's in black and white. And I don't understand that mentality. And it's maybe because I kind of grew up with these a little bit, or I grew up with black and white movies. I've never had that feeling, but I do have the feeling about, you know, foreign language films. And I know that you and Mac are not afraid of subtitles, but you know, I sometimes am, and I have to be like, oh, my head hurts or I can't do it now. And it is sometimes a factor in making a decision of what to watch, but I don't understand the old movie, the black and white thing, because I mean, hands down, I can tell you there are just masterful pieces of art that are just never going to be stumbled upon by you if this is something that you cannot waver on. I don't understand it.
I mean, I've tried to understand that too. And thinking about Mac has just turned 27, and I think he would have had to go out of his way to see black and white media, you know, like, I mean, his whole life, everything's been in color. And, you know, so it must seem kind of weird. It's kind of like, I'm trying to think what an analog would be. It's like, the only thing I could think of is like 2D animation. Like if you've only ever seen 3D animation and you're aware that 2D animation exists, be like, why would I watch that when I can watch,
yeah,
you know, the super hyper realistic stuff that we have. But yeah, I totally agree. I mean, if you limit but I also want to say that I do, I mean, in general, I'm not afraid of subtitles, but there are some times when I just want to zone out and I don't want to have to, you know, focus on, you know, the acting and the reading. And I mean, it is an extra process, I guess, especially if I don't know the language at all. It's difficult sometimes for me to watch a movie that in a language I don't know. And I have to read the screen and stuff. And sometimes I have to watch the movie twice because the first time I was reading subtitles mostly. And the second time, you know, I can focus more on the story and the acting and stuff. So I get it. But if you're willing to, you know, keep an open mind, there are worlds of cinema that are open to you.
Yeah.
Whether it's animation or international film or black and white films.
Yeah. And I guess I don't understand the mentality that I won't do it. You know, there's so many people that are very much willing to try it, even though it's not their cup of tea and maybe they can't get into it, and that's okay. I'm cool with that. But to make a comment, like, it's from 1944, so of course, some slack to them. I'm sure the movie was good back in the day. Well, no, if you... it's just, I want to shake that person, because it's... there's so many reasons that this movie is a great movie, and none of them are because it was good at the time.
Yeah.
That's not a reason. I don't know.
I agree. Now, there might be things that, you know, in some of the, and there are things in some of the films that we watch that are completely, you know, when we watch them today, they're like cringe or they're outdated or we've, you know, society has changed its mind on whatever, you know. And so I get that. And I think if you were coming from, coming from a 27-year-old's perspective, looking back on the mores of American society in the 1920s or something, you might be like, wow, you backward motherfuckers, this is difficult for me to watch.
Yeah.
I get all that, but I don't think this is that so much. I think this is just, these people are dressed different, they talk slightly differently, you know, and I don't think that should be enough for, you know, to disqualify you from giving the movie a chance.
Yeah, I agree. And I guess for this one, there's a extra layer that it's in black and white. It was made in 1944. But then there's the other layer of it's also set in the late 1800s. So, I mean, it's maybe a little bit colder water to get into, but it's worth it once you're in.
Just take a chance. You might like it. You might learn something.
Yeah.
If not, you're only out 2 hours of your time.
Right. Yeah.
Jacob Trash gave it a half star. I mean, be honest, the movie wasn't that good. Oh, you enjoyed yourself? You were invested? Please, dear. You must have watched an entirely different movie than me. Maybe you dreamed it? You've really lost your taste, haven't you?
So is this like, is he just like, does he really like it?
It's hard to tell, but I thought that was pretty well done.
Oh, that was...
Jacob Trash?
Yeah, that was done way more successfully than my attempt at gaslighting earlier. That was great.
I don't know, because I had already read that. That was already in my head, and you still got me. So I think it was still successful.
I wasn't planning on doing that, so it wasn't as well done as I could have probably had a, like, given it a few minutes of thought, but I wanted to at the moment.
I think that was so funny, though.
It's not 114 minutes.
Well, because I looked up the 1940 version, because that one review said it's this one is just longer, which I disagree with, but it is longer. The 1940 version is 89 minutes. So that part is true, but... we've already answered the questions. So I want to thank you, Gwen, for joining me for this conversation about Gaslight. I don't know whose idea it was. I'm going to say it was mine, but you were game to do it, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, it was your idea. Thank you. Sorry. Yeah. It was, yeah.
I really wanted to talk to you about it on mic.
Yeah.
Thank you, Wohos and Q-Balls, for joining us for this special edition Quinnysode. Next time on the Quinnysode, Quinny and I will be looking at Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte, which also features
Joseph Cotton,
Olivia de Havilland,
and Bette Davis.
And of course, the Queen.
Yeah.
The Queen.
We need more Bette Davis in our life right now, so this is a good time.
And I've never seen it, Q-Ball, so excited. Next time on the main show, Mac and I will be looking at possession movies. We will be reviewing The Exorcist from the U.S. and The Wailing from South Korea. We would love it if you subscribed and left us a 5-star rating. But we'd be just as happy if you told all your friends all about us. On that, a shout out to Wohos in various area codes. Our last Quinisode was downloaded in Frankfurt, Germany, Greensboro, North Carolina. We're world famous in Greensboro. Sacramento, California, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Ashburn, Virginia, Hamilton, Ontario, Nanaimo, BC, Del Valle, Texas, Nightdale, North Carolina, and Campina Grande in Brazil. If you would like a specific shout out, please get in touch. Remember, Q-Balls, we love you. Don't go into the basement. And
we're world famous in North Carolina?
Yes.